You're about to meet someone who's been involved in handing out 3 million meals to people in desperate need. He's worked with people society was happy to ignore, injecting drug users, people at risk of abusing their children, and kids at risk. Bill Cruz became a figurehead at Sydney's Wayside Chapel in the early 70s and went on to have his own ministry. He's revered by many people. But it took a freezing, muddy day in a makeshift tent covered with snow with a group of strangers to help him connect with some of his own needs. Bill Cruz's memoir is called 12 Rules for Living a Better Life. Bill, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm honoured to be here.
Well, it's a very great pleasure to have you in the studio with us today. And thanks. I want to jump ahead a little bit to this moment in your book in a place called The Jungle, this refugee camp in Calais.
Yeah.
And you ended up at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Tell us why it was such an important moment for you that day.
Oh, there'd been a whole lot of things leading up to that over quite a few years. And I'd been involved a lot with 12-step people. And I thought, well, I go to England, I do a lot of stuff there, and I was going over to look at the refugees and work with them in Calais, and there's 15,000 of them trying to get to England. They believed all that stuff about England being the great bastion of democracy and freedom, but the door was bolted to them. And so I'd been going there a bit, and one day I saw this sign, it said NA meeting. And I thought, I'll go to that. And it was a bit of carpet, like you said, on the snow, on a floodplain, with wood and plastic and glass and crap everywhere. And sitting in a circle were 20 people, men and women, from all over the world, all refugees, all Muslims, all tearing their story. And they were all speaking in their own language, so I couldn't understand it. And it was being translated into French, so I couldn't even understand that. And then it, but you could see it on their faces. You didn't need language. You could see the pain and the suffering and the struggle. And it got to me. And because suffering speaks all languages. And I thought, what am I going to say? And I said, oh, I'm Bill from Australia, because I'm not an addict or anything. I said, I'm Bill from Australia. They went, English, English. And I said, no, I'm terribly sorry. I can't get you to England. And then it all poured out of me, you know. And I said, oh, I'm Bill from Australia, and I've had 2 stuffed marriages, and my kids have suffered because of that, and blah, 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 blah. It all poured out all over the place. And they all got up, and they all held me. And they gave me my life back. And they were the lowest, the people we regard of the lowest of the low of the low. They were refugees. They were Muslims. All the people we bar out of this country gave me my life back.
It's really interesting, Bill, that you put that blah, blah, blah in there. I'm telling my story, but what does it matter compared to these people who have suffered, as you say, so much? But it seems to me sometimes that the people who spend so much time caring for others, that has an impact when they neglect their own stories and the truth that's going on inside them.
Well, I say to all my volunteers, because my centre now is in Ashfield in Sydney, and I say to all my volunteers, don't expect not to be changed by what happens. And they all say, no, we won't be changed. And they all do, because it's a two-way thing. And if you believe you're so full of yourself, you can fix all these problems up, it doesn't work that way. It comes back and it changes you.
Now, I made an error earlier. I said you'd been at the Wayside Chapel off and on for 50 years, but no, you were there in those heady early days.
I was there until 1983, 84. And it was terrible. It was all the corruption, you could follow the police going down the road, taking the money off the girls. You could do all of that stuff. And it was a really corrupt place. And I had to be very careful with the volunteers, making sure they didn't get corrupted by what was going on.
But let's go back a little bit further, Bill, because you were your family came from England.
England.
And you had a difficult relationship with your dad, didn't you?
Well, my dad was one of the kind of slum kids of London in a way, and he and his brother used to walk the streets collecting horse dung and selling it for a penny farthing a bag to give money to their single mum. So he'd tell me these stories and cry, you know.
Which sounds unlike him. Like he does, he sounds like a bit of a tough guy generally.
Well, he was hard to penetrate because he'd been through the Depression, he'd been through World War II, all of those sorts of things, and you just got on with life. You just put all your emotions and all your feelings into a pocket and zipped it up and got on with your life. And that's what he said to me. He said, Billy, he said, a quid's your best friend, you know, because during the Depression he'd seen people selling their bank books because they just needed money. To always have that very, very staunchly conservative. But he had a sense of social justice too.
And you ended up...
And he gave me a tough time.
Well, yeah, because...
Because I was a dreamer.
You were quite different from...
I was a dreamer.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, and my brother, he was like my dad. So, you know, if somebody had said to me, Billy, you've been adopted, I'd have said, why hadn't you told me that earlier?
Well, and it sounds like your brother made a big impact in the family, and he made a big impact leaving this world too, didn't he? What happened? Oh.
Yes, my father had moved to Tenterfield because he was chief engineer there, and my brother had gone up there, and he and I, we'd always had a bit of difficulties, you know, and up there we'd cemented our relationship and it was really good. And 2 days later he was dead. He'd been coming home from a dance and a couple of drunken youths in different cars were racing down the road and drove him off the road and killed him.
Yeah, and back in those days, cars did not survive crashes very well, did
cars
they?
Cars did not, no. And they were drunk and there was beer cans all over the road, all of that sort of stuff. It was terrible.
Mm. And that had a big impact on the family, didn't it?
Well, my dad, he took all the photos down and wouldn't mention his name for 30 years. Not. It was just terrible. My poor mum tried to struggle with all of that.
And the impression in your book, Bill Cruise, 12 Rules for Living a Better Life, is that that family experience growing up and your experiences at school too had a huge impact on the way you were looking for something in the world. You're looking for something more.
Yeah, well, yeah, I did. I had a real struggle. I was really bullied at school, all of that sort of stuff. And yeah, what kept me alive, I think, was reading. And I'd find there was actually something different. And there was actually this thing in the world called justice, you know. And for a while I was addicted to, as a young kid, reading those Westerns, which were all really social justice in a bullet in the head way, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah.
But they talked about goodness, yeah, and how goodness should win. But it doesn't always.
And they had an interesting relationship with lawlessness, didn't they, the Westerns?
Yeah.
Because they were people who were on the fringes, on the outside, yeah, but struggling with ethics.
And the rulers were often the corrupt ones.
Exactly, yeah. So we're speaking with Bill Cruise, who was drawn to the Wayside Chapel in the early 70s, went on to have his own ministry in Ashfield in Sydney, and has written a memoir called 12 Rules for Living a Better Life. You mentioned before, obliquely, Bill, that you were bullied at school. Tell us what happened when there was a reunion and they asked you to come back.
They wrote to me. They wrote to me and said, come back and speak at this reunion. And I said, bugger off. I said, I was bullied at that school. And anyway, they contacted me again and the headmaster apologised. And it was really awful because it was one of those schools where, you know, had all the Rhodes Scholars on the walls, all of that sort of stuff. And they were all bullying me. And then when I went back to the school, the only honour name on the wall was mine. And that really shook me because I hated the place. I still, when I smell that smell in the corridors of schools, it reminds me of how awful it was.
But you had an interesting conversation with someone at the dinner table when you did go back, didn't you?
Yeah, one of them. I was sitting there and the guy who was one of the head bullies was sitting next to me and I thought, how the hell am I going to deal with this? Because I was quite shaken up and all that. And as I sat down, he said, well, didn't we have a terrible time there? And I realised all those kids were really unhappy and they were taking it out on each other. And it kind of opened me up to see the other side.
And did it make you think, well, you know, we were Lord of the Flies, where were the adults?
Oh, yeah. But it was a pretty tough time. That was up in Townsville. And it was a pretty tough world up there. And it was years, just, you know, less than 10 years or more than around 10 years since they were worried about being invaded by the Japanese. So it was a tight community.
Mm. So here's this young man, he's graduated from school and he's a bit dreamy and his dad decides to get him a traineeship to be an engineer.
Yeah.
What was that like for you as a path in life for that time?
Oh, it was all right. The company paid me the basic wage while I was at university. So I did pretty well and got into research of single crystal silicon and looked at if you added extra atoms in the silicon thing, what would happen. So that was quite interesting, except the gases I was using were gases that were laced with phosphorus and arsenic and all those. And the symptoms of arsenic poisoning and that were palpitations and sweaty palms. Well, I had them just looking at the bottles, if you know what I mean. So that I wasn't the world's best engineer, but I was as good as I could be. But it really, I couldn't, if I look back, oh, what a dead-end job. But it was, you know, that was what my parents wanted, you know, in a way.
Well, and you were partly responsible for touchtone telephones and pacemakers, I
hear.
That's
right. That's right. We did all that stuff. And, and then when I had to leave, my dad said, you know, you're throwing away a good job. But a few years later, the company went to the wall and I was the only one who had a job.
Sometimes it's nice to be able to look at your parents and say, see?
Yeah.
So, Bill Cruz, I want to go back to that time after your brother died and you were living away from your family then. You had a really interesting interaction with a minister. Tell us about that.
Oh, God. An uncle, kind of an uncle, had come and told me my brother had died and I couldn't get back up to Townsville, Tenterfield. And I was in real shock and I'd just made up with him. You know, so it was terrible, terrible. And I'm wandering around like a headless chook around the suburbs. And I end up going into this church to talk to the minister. And he was worse than hopeless. Worse. Oh, my God. I went in to tell him all of this and he kind of didn't know how to deal with it. And at the end said, well, if you're feeling like that, I feel really sorry for your mother. And I went away feeling worse than I came. And that's something that's driven me a lot about ministry and churches and priests and ministers and all of that and how loving compassion often is missing.
It was a real what not to do moment, but very shortly afterwards, I understand, you found yourself drawn to this place full of amazing energy and amazing people called the Wayside Chapel.
Wayside Chapel. It was, you had everybody there from Sir Robert Heltman to Andrea, who was a huge radio star in Sydney, all the wealthy people and all the homeless people as well. And so, and everybody was mixing up together. Plus, it was the centre of the counterculture. So you had all the hippies, half of the cast of Hair was staff of the Wayside Chapel. So you had Bob Dylan in every corner and I felt I'd come home.
We're going to talk a little bit more to Bill Cruz in a moment about the Wayside Chapel and this incredible tribe that he found himself part of and where that led him in his life. The new book's called 12 Rules for Living a Better Life and you're listening to Life Matters. Hilary Harper here with you on Radio National and our guest today is Reverend Bill Cruz of the Bill Cruz Foundation. He's got a new memoir out and it's really interesting reading about what shapes a life path and the kind of influences that make you end up where you do end up. So Bill, you met this really charismatic person who eventually led you through to the Wayside Chapel. Tell us a little bit about this time.
Oh, John Webster was, because we in Sydney you had the Domain, which was Speaker's Corner on a Sunday, and by far the best speaker there was a guy called Webster, who spoke a lot in Hyde Park in London. When I go there, I speak in his memory at Hyde Park, and he said he was speaking at the Wayside Chapel, and he was amazing. He'd been. He was Muslim and all of these sorts of things. And
he'd been a communist, he'd been a fascist, he'd moved through a lot of thoughts.
All of that. He started off as a runner for Ramsay MacDonald, and he'd worked for the Booth family. So he knew General Booth and Branwell Booth from the Salvation Army. He knew all the scandals. Just he'd been also an advisor to NASA, President NASA. So he knew a lot of stuff, and he was fascinated. And he said, I'm speaking at the Wayside Chapel. So I went up to listen to him and then came across this charismatic guy. Like, just imagine, you know, he's this minister in a white suit, white tie, white shoes, white everything up there on the stage, you know. Classic Leo, for those who believe in the star signs. Classic. And he's saying, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And I thought, well, I don't want to end my days feeling I'm part of the problem.
It sounds like they were real thinkers too. You were drawn not just to the work but to the ideas.
Oh, all of that. The best debate I saw it there was a debate between Jack Mundey, the leader of the unions and the communists, and John Singleton, who had started the Workers' Party, which was a right-wing party. And the two of them were going hammer and tongs debating. And I realised the ultimate vision they were looking for was the same. It was just they were going down different pathways. And that moved me a lot as well. And there were a lot of religious people who would come and argue and all of that as well.
And Bill, you write that, you know, you started getting involved in this work, you started turning up all the time and helping with volunteering and projects, and you went on to lead your own parish, you went on to start foundations and launch youth refuges and lots of different things, but you also write that you never felt like a proper leader, even as an adult. What was going on there?
I think I was a good second in command. I've been looking back, so I was in the Boy Scouts, and the head wrote a letter saying I was a good leader, and I'd never seen my... I didn't really believe, because I'd had such a hard childhood and schooling and that, I didn't really believe I was much good at anything. Anything. I remember the first time I turned up at the Wayside Chapel, they said, drive this four-wheel from here to there. I thought, I can't do that. They said, get in and do it. And I did it. And I realised I could do things. And my whole life, my whole growing up has been realising all the things I can do that my childhood told me I couldn't.
Well, and you talk a lot in the book about doing rather than talking about doing. How do you feel like we're doing with that in Australia these days?
Not too well. We could do better. Could do better. A lot of pontificating, a lot of that sort of stuff. And we seem to have lost our commonality and the fact that we're all in this life together. I think in lots of ways the Irish have kind of saved Australia because they've got that anti kind of authoritarian attitude and everything. And
cheeky.
Yeah, cheeky. And we've lost that and we've become miserly. As we've got richer, we've become more miserly and we become more acquisitive and we think stuff means something. Rennie Rivkin once said to me, he who dies with the most wins. And I think a lot of people have that philosophy in a way.
Well, and I would have thought, Bill, that with all your work you'd be a bit hard to shock, but I understand that quite recently you went in a van to Western Sydney and you had one of those eye-opening moments of seeing poverty in action. Why is it so bad right now?
I have no idea. This country is so wealthy and people are so wealthy, and yet there are people come to my restaurant who share false teeth. You know, they just eat one meal and give it to their mate. And you think, my God, this is Australia. 2021 and there will be people, you know, whinging because, you know, the hair dryer didn't turn out the right way. And we got people suffering like that. You go into some of the remote Aboriginal communities and it's like Cambodia. We get women turning up now at our place, right, in need, escaping domestic violence, and they'll have one day left on the Bentley. So they'll all be sleeping in the Bentley and then it's gone and they got nothing. And people forget that to be grateful for what they've got and to share. I think the bushfires and the floods started us thinking in that direction. And the pandemic is starting to think us in that direction. But there's often this thing about the deserving and the undeserving poor. And the often it's such a sad thing because a lot of the people, all they need is a bit of a boost and a bit of a mind expansion so that they, like I had a kid, you know, a little Aboriginal kid. We were teaching him to read. We talked him into learning to read because that way he could get a driver's license. As he starts to read and he reads all his books and things, he says to me one day, I just realised I can go to university if I want to. Bang. Like, wow. Powerful.
Yeah. Well, and Bill, you run something called the Exodus Foundation.
Yeah.
And that started with a donation, which must have been quite heartening. What does it do now?
We've given away about 3 million meals, I think. At the moment, we do about 1,000 meals a day. That's half go into our restaurant, Loaves and Fishes, and the rest go out on vans to various areas. And those areas are starting to expand because a lot of agencies closed down. We decided we weren't going to close down during COVID. We were going to be there as COVID safe as we could be, and we did it. And what annoys me really are so many, the most vulnerable people are the last ones getting the vaccines. I've been trying to get homeless people to get the vaccines from the beginning, you know, and they're not on anybody's agenda. And homeless people wander around, they're kind of petri dishes of this, so they could spread that. And nobody does anything. And I think, what are those people in Canberra doing? How come they've stuffed it up so badly? And these are really needy people who are vulnerable and they're the ones who could spread it, you know? So if ever there's a reason to say we're all in this life together, it's now. And we better look after the poorest of the poor now because they can come back and bite us on the bum.
Well, and speaking of things that can come back to bite you on the bum, I know you have a lot of conversations with a whole different range of people and that can go either way sometimes. What's it been like towing the line within the church structures? I mean, Ted Noff's got accused of heresy.
Yeah, well, I used to think, because Ted was a bit of an argumentative.
No, really?
Yeah, and I used to think, if I behave differently, they'd treat me differently. And it doesn't. Churches are really just like banks. They're risk averse. They're timid. And so that they might talk about, you know, the power of this and that and the other, but very few exhibit it.
And what about talking to what's traditionally seen as quite a conservative radio audience on the Sydney station 2GB? Your priority issues are welfare
and
social justice. Well,
that's fascinating because if you say refugees, you get, But if you talk about Omar, whose leg was blown off and his little daughter's got one eye and he needs this and he needs that, they'll give everything. They'll give everything so that it's how the message is sold. And you'll notice political parties are getting better at hiding stuff so that, you know, put them on Manus Island or somewhere where nobody can see the horrors that are going on, you know? And it's sad because they're ordinary people. This is what I've learned. I was with a whole lot of them escaping Islamic State or Daesh, you know, and all they want is somewhere for their kids to grow and their family to grow and all of this. And we label them something which is almost subhuman. And once we make human beings subhuman, we can allow anything to be done to them.
Before we run out of time together, Bill Cruise, you have four children, you've been married twice, and you write in the book that you wish that your close family relationships had been more successful. What's that down to, do you think? Is it about your own upbringing and how difficult that was, or is it about the amount of time you've devoted to your work?
It's probably everything. It's kind of like most of what I do, I had this experience which got me into this sort of stuff. And the experience said, by the way, your personal life won't be that happy. And that's enabled me to struggle through it, you know. But what I've learned in all of this is that, sure, you stuff up, but you can circle back. You can circle back and start again. And that's what took me 10 years. But you can circle back and rebuild those relationships that have been damaged.
This is sounding a little bit Buddhist, and I know that you're friends with the Dalai Lama. In fact, you were guest judges on MasterChef in 2010. What was that like?
Oh, just something you did.
Just a bit weird.
He came with me. We fed 400 homeless people at Ashfield, and it was wonderful. And I had to keep all the toffs out because they all kept saying, I want to come and I want to, no, this is for the homeless people. And it was wonderful. And he was giving them all grandfatherly lectures about what to do and all of this. And honestly, some of them didn't wash their hands for ages because he'd touched them. And that was really moving to me. But I was with him last time I was with him, because we talk a bit, and I was in Dharamsala with him, and we were talking, and I said, look into my eyes. We looked into one another's eyes. I said, did you know she disappeared as we were talking? I said, I think that's what Jesus was talking about the kingdom. And he goes, oh. And he signals to a minion, you know, and comes back, and the minion comes back with this glass obelisk or this crystal obelisk, and the Dalai Lama draws a cross on it with black pen, and he gives it to me, and he says, take that as a gift from the Holy Spirit. He's an amazing, amazing human being, amazing. How he can live and survive with all the butchery that's going on with these people is beyond me. And I saw an old man, we were together once, and an old man fell to the ground and kissed his feet. And I thought, that's greatness, greatness.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that you two are friends, because greatness comes in many different forms. Bill Cruise, thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
Thank you.
Bill Cruise, Reverend Bill Cruise of the Bill Cruise Foundation, formerly of the Wayside Chapel back in the day. His memoir is called 12 Rules for Living a Better Life.